Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. Be sure to smash that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all because joining the mothership is Tyler Burden Smith. You know him as the writer and creator of Slumber from Image Comic Books. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Smith. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Completely my pleasure. I'm really enjoying what you're doing with Slumber from Image.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm excited that people are latching onto it. It's a really fun project for me.
So I always like to start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired you to become a writer and who are your earliest influences?
Oh, man. I think like definitely when I was a kid, there were kind of like three big influences for me. Like many people my age, I guess like Steven Spielberg was a big one, just in terms of like when I saw Jurassic Park in theaters, that was like one of the most mind-blowing experiences of my life. And I thought like, if I can write something that makes people feel how I feel right now, then that would be the most magical thing in the world. And a lot of my, I do write for film. So a lot of my influences were film-based, but basically that film, and then I saw Fargo by the Coen brothers, and I grew up in a small town that feels like Fargo in a lot of ways, complete with all the like dark, horrific underpinnings that go with that story. I'm always drawn to dark humor and spectacle, and like I think those two like fueled a lot of the how I love to write, which is like Spielberg comes with a lot of heart and a lot of world building and showing you like the magic of the world, and the Coen brothers is really about like showing you the dark underbelly and with usually with like a twisted sense of humor. So those, and I think The Thing was like the third thing that like, you know, if that was like my triangle of influences, that would be it. I love horror. I love genre film in general. And so I think those three movies were really what inspired me to write a lot. I also played a lot of narrative video games growing up, like Click and Point Adventures. And those were quite, you know, inspiring for me as well growing up in terms of like writing. I didn't even think that it was possible. I did some writing for video games, and that was like a dream job for me for a long time. Like it was one of those things you didn't think was possible. I think those were a big thing. And of course, you know, Marvel Comics. I was just like all about all that stuff. So those were definitely big influences for me.
So when you say The Thing, you mean the 1950s thing or the John Carpenter thing?
The John Carpenter. Yeah, definitely.
I know my father would want me to ask because he's a huge fan of the 1950s, The Thing. There'd been a moment.
Yeah.
But no, I kind of figured John Carpenter. You know, the kind of funny thing is with Jurassic Park, it's one of the few times I actually remember my movie experience when I first saw it. And that movie, I think I was 13 years old. That movie blew me away. I was like, I just remember like when the Brachiosaur first shows up on screen, I mean, I was like frozen and like just like excitement, you know what I'm saying? It was like this weird like frozen awe.
I think it's one of those things, you know, every generation seems to have a film like that, like, you know, 15 years or whatever before that it was Star Wars, I think, and there are those kind of really profound experiences that people of a certain age get to have, and that was a really special one. I think most people I would talk to that are of that kind of age remember that very clearly.
So as you mentioned, you're an accomplished movie writer, video game writer, comic book writer. Now, does one passion come first?
Not really. I mean, you know, so I usually, when I come up with an idea, I try and think of what medium it works best in. And I've just kind of like tumbled my way into my dream was always to write for film as a kid. And you know, I've been very fortunate to be able to do that. But along the way, you know, I always grew up loving comics so much, and didn't really know how to get into that. I didn't know how to get into any of this stuff. But I've just kind of, you know, traversed through this weird career I've had and found different mediums to create things in. But I knew I always wanted to write for comics, and because I have more experience writing for film, I felt like if I create a comic, I want it to be something that feels like it has to be in that medium, or like this is the best medium to tell that story. And with Slumber, I actually started out, you know, it was just this idea I had lingering in my head for a long time, or different parts of this idea. And when it came together, I was originally thinking maybe this works as a TV show. But as soon as I started, you know, writing things down, I felt like this really is a comic book. Like, it's so visual, and I could just kind of see it on the page in my head. And you know, as soon as I start having those visuals of like panels, it felt like this has to be the medium that this exists in, and this has to be the first comic I create. So I was really hoping that would happen, and very lucky that it did. And super appreciative that Image agreed to publish it for us.
You know, what I found was fascinating is that I think it's the first comic book I've seen that actually credits the editor on the cover. And the editor is Heather Antos, who everyone in the comic book world knows for, you know, I mean, I think she's edited for Image. Was it Valiant as well before? I mean, she's edited a lot of books. So was there a conscious decision to make sure the editor this time got credit? And what did Ms. Antos bring to the project?
I mean, Heather's been super helpful for me. And because this is my first, you know, I've read a lot of comics. I continue to read comics, you know, on a daily basis. But as a first time writer for comics, I think Heather probably had more to do than she's probably used to on other comics, just in terms of like dumb questions and things like this, and you know, this doesn't work for this reason or whatever. So you know, just in terms of all the structuring, all the, you know, and I'm also colorblind. I'm horrendously colorblind, so like me giving notes on colors and all this kind of stuff is just a nightmare. And she's been incredibly helpful throughout the process. She's also like a talented artist, so she just has a different eye, and I think we approach things from kind of a different viewpoint in a good way. So you know, we're looking at different things when we look at the book. But in terms of credit, like, yeah, I don't know. I never really thought much about it. I guess just that was the core team that, you know, did all the work on the book, and we did different things on the book, but just felt like we should all be on the cover. So if that, yeah, I know that's not always the case, but just felt right, I guess.
So being a novice comic book writer, I mean, obviously you had read comic books, as you have said, from Marvel, but as a novice comic book writer, what surprised you, or that you either knew or didn't know about comic books writing, getting into it? Like, was it something that you're like, oh, this is how, you know, you put together a comic book, or this is something about writing a comic book that I never even thought about before?
I think something that was difficult for me, like, I think one of the things that's actually quite cool about comic books, like, you, when you're writing for other mediums, you're not thinking of page turns, you know, like this should land at the bottom right side of the right page, and then the reveal should be as soon as we flip on the left, you know, every two pages. Not like you have to follow that religiously, but like just thinking in terms of like, where's the person going to look in what order, and where do we like surprise the reader or compel the reader to keep reading? You know, that's not really the case with like you know, I mean, in novels you have like chapters and things like this that you do this, but on a constant kind of basis, having to think of like how that looks as you write. Yeah, I mean, it is, in some ways it's kind of similar to film in that it's a bit of a blueprint, you know, you're writing something for somebody else to, create beautiful art out of. So you're kind of describing what you think should be, on the page. I think the thing that took the most, getting used to for me was like what level of description do I use? Or like, how do I, Vanessa's like an incredibly talented artist, but like, how do I give her a clear sense of my vision while also like allowing enough open for her to like bring her vision to it? So it doesn't just feel like, you know, 18 lines of me describing every single element on the page, but more like the feeling of what's on the page, or the important story elements, but like giving her room to really like explore different avenues as she goes. And some of the, you know, wildest details that I love most in the comic are things that, you know, Vanessa just kind of took on her own and took a left turn that I didn't expect in an excited way. So yeah, that's those elements were kind of like fun challenges, though. I think it's just, you know, it took some getting used to, but it's a bit of a puzzle that was really fun to kind of figure out.
You know, I know how a movie script actually is written, and obviously I've written some comic books. I know how a comic book script is written. So I mean, it's a bit of a segue, but I did. But when you write a video game, are you also writing it in script form or is it long form?
It depends on the studio, but most game studios have a screenwriting software that's pretty similar to like standard movie writing softwares like Final Draft and Movie Maker and stuff like this. But because it's video games usually have some form of branching content, like this will happen if you do this. So usually there's kind of internal systems that account for those things. So you're creating stuff in a software where you're also plugging in like kind of values, if that makes sense, or plugging in like, if the player does this, then this dialogue will play. If they did not do this, then this dialogue will play. And elements like that. But the approach is very similar. Like, and I think more and more video game stories are starting to feel more like film or TV. And that's because the approach is kind of merged a lot more. So, you know, it's a tricky medium in the sense that like you're in production as you're writing. So often like elements are changing and the game is changing. You're kind of writing around these things or figuring out how to adjust, which is kind of the opposite of comics where, you know, you're writing the whole thing and then somebody is drawing it. So it's a lot more chaotic in that way. And so the challenges are a little bit different.
Yeah. That's weird, because like I said, when I write a comic book or I write anything, you know, you kind of want to, you read it in the linear way, you know, story, this happens, and you read the script, you go into the next scene, you're like, okay, this works well, and you're reading the flow, and you're following the flow. When you're writing a video game script, then with all the different options, you're reading in zigzags, aren't you? You're kind of like, well, here, but I'm kind of going here, but I got to remember to go back and read what would happen. This makes sense. I mean, that's gotta be feels to me like an awkward way of writing.
It can be. I'm pretty lucky, like for all my faults, like I think one of my strengths is I'm good at keeping the mind map of everything in my brain, just like this weird web of stuff that happens or doesn't happen. So I actually kind of enjoy that, but yeah, I definitely, key is always to like figure out the through line, like what the core emotional story is that like builds this story out and then expand outwards. And as long as you keep that in mind, I think the other things become a lot easier.
And when you're writing something, once again, like Slumber, which is a comic book, in a world where comic books are now in every other medium, eventually, you know, are you thinking thematically as well, or so thematically as well, when you're looking at writing Slumber, like, well, this is a comic book, but, you know.
Yeah, well, like I said, I chose this premise, this story as a comic because I felt like that's where it belonged. You know, it's something I would be open to exploring as a show or a movie in the future. But like, I'm also just, it's fun for me to just allow this to kind of exist as it is, you know, because it's its own thing in this medium. And for me, that's really special. And you know, it was a very small team kind of creating this thing from start to finish. So it's very much our DNA in this version of what it is. So who knows, maybe at some point in the future, we'll see. But for right now, I'm just excited to have it in this form.
Well, an interesting thing about Slumber is the protagonist, Stetson. She's really kind of interesting. She asked for those readers who haven't picked up the first two issues of Slumberite, which are out, people. So go to your comic store and find them out and find them right now. She kills nightmares for money, basically. That's kind of her job. Right. So what makes her, one, particularly skilled at this job? And two, is she doing it to help the clients or because she's just kind of like good at it? And it's part of, you know, if you're good at something, as the Joker said, if you're good at something, never do it for free, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So my, not to like ruin too much about the story, but like the thing that I find fun about this character is like, she's not the best at her job. She's not like some elite special agent, nightmare hunter. She's just a woman with a shotgun who goes into your dreams and, you know, gets paid an okay amount of money to do her best to like track down your nightmares and kill them so you can sleep at night. And she royally fucks up sometimes. She'll like kill the wrong thing. And when you kill something in the dream world, it erases your memories of that thing in your mind. So people can like forget who their grandma is or God knows what she'll screw up. But she's basically the only person you can go to for this because she's the only person who has this technology. And she didn't even build this technology. She kind of stumbled upon it, which is something that's kind of hinted and built at later on. Like, where did this technology come from? Why does she have this dream rig that she has? But basically, she's this person who came into this because of something that happened to her daughter, who had recurring nightmares. And that'll be explored more in the series as well. Like, what her origin is and how she got into this business. But you know, she's been obsessed with finding this very specific nightmare that is somehow connected to her daughter. And, you know, having this technology and running this business for her selfishly is her only way to kind of find this nightmare and where it exists in people's minds and find a way to kill it. But at the same time, you know, she's somebody who has like, spent so much of her time inside other people's dreams, she's kind of lost her grasp on reality outside of the dream world. And so she's somebody who like almost forgot how the rules of our real world work. And so for somebody like Stetson, it's almost like going to a dinner party would be her worst nightmare. Whereas like being in somebody's dreams where you can just take a shotgun and take all of your aggression out and, you know, have sex with dream version of David Bowie or whatever the hell, get drunk in somebody's dream bar. You know, she's just kind of gone wild and let go of her connection with reality. And that's kind of a big part of who her character is. And Finch on the other side, who's this detective who's investigating the real life murders that have occurred, right? I don't know if I should explain this. Yeah, so basically the B story of Slumber is that in the real world, there are a series of murders that have been committed by different people, and they're somehow connected by a mysterious symbol that all these people have carved or etched into the ground or walls when these murders have been committed, and all of these people claim that they were asleep when these murders occurred. And so Detective Finch is this homicide investigator who's investigating this case and trying to figure out why all this is happening. And you know, the kind of cat and mouse between these two people, and also like the friction of them, is it's their polar opposites in every way, and kind of bringing those two minds together is really a lot of the fun of this series and seeing them kind of play off each other.
So there's a lot of unpack there that I'm curious about. The first part is, when you mention killing a nightmare affects memories, okay? So when she every nightmare that she kills or sets and kills, she's killing a part of the dreamer.
Yes.
And so the dreamer wakes up, it's not going to be quite the same person as the person when they went to sleep then, because they're losing a part of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a hell of a bit of a responsibility that you're not only killing the nightmare, but you are killing part of the individual as well, which... You know, is that, I mean, morally, how does that impact the dreamer and how she views her job?
Yeah, so this is something that, like, Stetson has kind of been trying to repress or ignore in order to keep doing her job. But basically, like, yeah, those are all valid questions. And the idea that, you know, we have nightmares for a reason. And usually part of it is to process things that we've gone through, things that are in our subconscious that maybe haven't been brought fully to light, or just like part of your brain cycle of figuring out life. And so Stetson, when she, you know, if you have a recurring nightmare about your uncle and she kills your uncle and erases him from your dreams, it's like the impact of that could be extremely profound in dangerous ways. And so what she's doing is quite dangerous and it's in a morally gray area, definitely at best. and yeah, that's definitely part of the interesting thing of this story is like, is she actually helping people? In some cases, maybe she is. Maybe it's just too much for these people to deal with or get through their day. Part of the inspiration for this story for me was that I had recurring nightmares many years ago that were extremely debilitating. And actually the central villain of the story is somewhat inspired by those nightmares, where I had this person in my dreams that could walk through shadows and use them as doorways to just kind of appear or emerge from any shadow around me. And he would just stand there. And it was so unnerving. And this happened every night for months. And, you know, I was doing all kinds of dream research and learning how to lucid dream and therapy and all kinds of stuff, trying to figure out where this came from. And, you know, eventually I worked through it and the nightmares went away. But I remember thinking like, God, if somebody could just like go into my dreams and fucking shoot that nightmare in the head and just make it go away. Like,
yeah,
it would have been so nice. And maybe I wouldn't have been the same person. Yeah. Maybe I wouldn't have worked through things that I needed to work through or my life would have been on a completely different path, but that's part of what's kind of explored in this comic in different ways. And the further it goes along, the more those questions kind of come to light.
Yeah, you know, I think the movie that I thought about when I was reading it was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Sure,
Where the question is, in the story, once again, the character Jim Carrey, for those who haven't seen the movie, wanted to kick out the memories of this girl that he fell in love with or whatever. The problem is, after he did it, the question then became, he didn't really want it to happen.
Right.
These dreamers, once again, is there a concern as well that these dreamers can't then back out and after the fact and say, oh, wait a second, I probably needed that, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a very thick contract you have to sign when you have this process, when this happens. But yeah, I mean, that those are all the right questions. And yeah, there will be people who Stetson erases their dreams and they don't really realize what they're losing in the process, because, you know, there is this kind of like spider web in your mind. And it's like, if you erase a person or a thing from your mind, basically, not just from your dreams, but from your memory, it's like, you don't know what that's connected to, what memories have changed in your mind or what you'll forget or what kind of shifts and the kind of ramifications of that can be huge, depending on what it is. So yes, that's definitely part of the gray area that Stetson plays in.
What is the cost for Stetson? Once again, when you're choosing these dreams, is that, I mean, can she die in a dream world? And what happens from there?
She can die. So basically the way this process works is she plugs the client into this dream rig, presses some buttons, and this red door opens. And this door is basically a physical doorway that Stetson can use to physically walk into that person's dreams. And when she's in the dreams, you know, this is a dream world, but she's real. And her partner, Jang, is also real. And if they die in the dream world, they die in reality, because it's not like Inception where, you know, you have things attached to your brain and you're asleep with them. It's like she's physically literally walking into this person's dreams. So it is life or death stakes for her and for anybody who follows her inside.
So if just out of curiosity, if she were to die in the dream, does this person then forever have a dream of the dead Stetson around in there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, somewhere in that person's dreamscape, there's a dead body that might just show up from time to time.
Oh, that sounds way worse than the nightmare.
Could be. Yeah, let's hope she doesn't die.
Right. Her partner is a goblin. What motivates him? And is he a rogue dream, or is he from somewhere else?
So his name is Jiang Shi, and basically he is a Jiang Shi, which is it's very aptly named. And Jiang Shi are these kind of zombie vampires from like Japanese horror films.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and they basically hop around, and their only weakness, they're kind of immortal, except that their only weakness is fried rice, depending on like the lore of the
weird.
There's all kinds of crazy rules. I just always love Jiang Shi. Like, I love these movies. I love Japanese horror, and I wanted to bring that into this world. But yeah, I mean, it's basically hinted at, and definitely I'm hoping that in future stories we'll show the backstory. But basically he's a dream character that Stetson was hired to kill, and then realized he's kind of immortal and decided to hire him as her sidekick. So that's how these two kind of ended up together.
So in the story, so a dream an entity that lives that's in the dreams, right? Is that then a true sentient entity? Is it something that's different? I mean, where are they in terms of existence?
Well, I mean, these are creations of somebody's mind that exist inside their dream world. But basically, Stetson has this door that nobody in the world should ever possess, that allows her to walk into people's dreams. But also she can take things out. So, you know, if you had a dream about Elvis, she could walk into your dream world, pull him out the door, and he exists in our world. But he's never going to be real Elvis. This isn't like the Elvis we all knew. It's one person's dream perception of what Elvis was. So what he looks like, what he sounds like, what he knows, what he says, the way he acts, his dance moves, whatever. You know, he might only sing with lyrics about this person's childhood, or like, you know, weird shit like that. So, you know, in a way, sure, sentient, but they're basically like puppets of somebody else's mind that Stetson is cutting the threads on and letting them walk on their own. So that's kind of the level that they exist in.
So what is the, am I going to pronounce it correctly, the Valkyra then?
So Valkyra is a nightmare entity that was born. I'm delicate not to reveal too much because it's a bit of the mystery of the story. But basically, she's a shadow walker, which is a type of nightmare that uses shadows as doorways and can, you know, disappear into or appear from any shadow around you when you're inside of this dream. But she has the ability, when she's inside of somebody's dream, she can take control of that person's dream self. And when she does that, take control of your body while you're asleep. So basically, you end up this sleepwalking person who Valkyra, this nightmare entity, is controlling and moving you through our world in reality. But she has this ability to actually transfer herself from one person's dreams to another quite specifically and intentionally. And that's part of the danger of this character is she's basically a serial killer that exists inside of your dreams. And she can take control of your body and make you do horrible things in the real world, commit murder, or just make you go naked walking through the streets, like whatever she feels like.
Right.
And then when she's done and bored, she can transfer to the next body, the next victim, and do it all over again. And so that's something that we're seeing through the story, how she operates and kind of following, you know, the tracking down of this serial killer that's incredibly difficult to find or pursue, because she can change bodies at any time.
So in issue, I think it's issue two. I might be wrong, but I think it's issue two. Valkyra refers to Stetson as a dream eater.
Yes.
What does she mean by that? Because, I mean, I know in the panel, it's actually a Jang that actually is eating actual dreams. So yeah. What makes Stetson a dream eater?
Well, you'll just have to keep reading to find out, I think.
Very good. Fair enough.
She doesn't, I will say, it's not because she literally eats dreams, but there is something about who she is and her backstory there's a reason she was given that name.
According to Stetson, Valkyra feeds on a person's darkest instincts. So the terrible things that people are doing while she's in them, are these connected to things the person was already kind of sort of somewhere in their darkness thinking about? And that's what they mean by eating their darker instincts? Or does she look for people who are just inherently have a darkness they possess somewhere? How does that work?
I kind of believe everybody has a darkness somewhere inside of them. And I think Valkyra, basically how she operates is she brings that out in the person. And so when she takes control of this person's mind, she's also kind of cognizant of what they think or feel as a part of that. And so while she's operating this person's body, you know, she knows the truth. That's basically like the danger of her. Like, you know, if somebody just hates their boss so much that they've thought about killing them, she knows that. These are the things like all of your darkest dreams that you would never do in reality, but have thought about, all those horrible, horrible ideas that you've had or moments of weakness or whatever. She finds that stuff delicious, and she just loves, you know, she's from a dream world where there are no repercussions for your actions. And there's something fascinating to her about suddenly exploring a world where it's the opposite of that. Where if somebody dies, they stay dead and people cry and there's reactions and this kind of fascination with this psychopath who doesn't really understand human behavior but wants to is a part of what really lures her to exploring our world.
So is Slumber a miniseries or a long form series?
It's intended to be a long form series. So first volume is kind of the first part of the story, but there's definitely more in the works.
Oh, very cool. When can our readers find the next issue of Slumber, or issue three? Because issue two already out there, people. Find it at your store.
Sorry, what was your question?
Where can our readers find, I guess it would be issue three, or when?
I believe it comes out, I should know the exact date, May 16th, maybe? Somewhere around that week, the Wednesday of that week, and it should be available in, you know, comic stores, wherever your local comic store is.
Well, like I said, Slumber, somebody read the first two issues so far. It's really entertaining, visually stunning as well. And right now I'm fascinated by the Valkyra. I want to say you did a great job, Mr. Smith, and I look forward to reading the next ones.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope you enjoy the series. I think it gets better as it goes. I think I learned a lot in this comic. So I'm really proud with how the first volume ends. And excited to see what people think. Thanks so much for having me.
Totally my pleasure. Have a fantastic night.
You too. Have a good day.